This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Denizens of the internet, hello, welcome. Rack Addicts After Hours time once again. We've now reached episode 56. That's a satisfying number. Not too sure why, but I like it. Just Pete and I today. My name's Ben. Thank you for tuning into our podcast about music a lot. There's some space in there. There's technology and just generally things that we like to talk about. Because you like to hear the sound of our own voice, I imagine. But how are you doing, Pete?
Not too bad. Not too bad at all today.
Not too bad. That's good for you, I think, maybe.
Yeah, no, it most probably is good for me, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, once again, Rack Addicts After Hours is after hours. We're not in the pub that we used to be in, which was amazing. That look, we were talking today about the lovely ambiance we used to have with the chinkings of glass, little ice cube tinkles and the sort of general hubbub, which was a nice background.
I miss it. I miss it so much.
Yeah, we never did. We should have just plopped the recorder down and just got some of that, the room tone to add back into the after hours thing.
I mean, like so many millions of people around the world, I just want my life back.
Totally. And I want the pub. It was nice when we were allowed out and we had a few suitably distanced podcasts in a park, in the sun, with some beers. It was excellent, really. But now we're in the winter and my sister had snow today, so it's, you know, miserable.
Yeah, the weather's not that thing. I mean, I've just been cleaving to the TV again, so I don't know if you are into those sort of things, but I watched the new Marvel series.
New Marvel series?
Which is WandaVision.
Well, what is that?
Well, basically, yeah, I don't know, are you familiar with the Marvel Universe?
Loosely. I mean, I got so sick of superhero films, I tuned out around about the second Captain America.
Okay. Well, Wanda is, I can't pronounce her second name, but she's, I don't know, some sort of telepathic person.
Mm.
And she was in the, do you ever see the one, I can't remember if it was the, I think it was the Avengers, the Sokovia thing.
Oh, yes, she has the sort of psychic and with the red-looking sort of...
Yeah, that's the one.
...particle effects.
Well,
yeah.
She's got a series with the gentleman called Vision, the android, the thing they made in that.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So I think the premise is that she's having this sort of... I don't know quite what it is. It's a surreal thing, but she's created it with her powers.
Mm.
So because she's so sort of bereaved or bereft of Vision being killed at the end of...
Spoilers.
Yes, well, I think most people have watched it now.
I haven't, but like I said, I don't really care.
But, yeah, so it's it starts off in the 1950s, and apparently they filmed it with 1950s TV technology in front
of
it. So it's done like a sitcom, like a typical... So each episode is like a American sitcom, but it moves decades each episode.
Interesting.
So
yeah, pretty cool.
So they seem to be releasing two episodes at a time, and... Without any particular spoilers, they basically went through two decades.
Mm.
And they're quite short episodes, I'm not sure. They're certainly no more than half an hour.
Yeah. And what platform is it on?
Disney Plus.
Oh, of course. I forgot they owned Marvel.
I mean, it may be available in sort of other platforms at a later stage, but it's their exclusive content.
Yeah.
And that's obviously how their value proposition that they're making for people to subscribe to to that channel.
Nice one. How long has that been going for?
Literally, as far as I was aware, it's released. The two episodes were released yesterday.
Oh wow, that is very hot off the press by Rack Addict standards.
Yes, certainly. So I watched those with my daughter, and we sort of wasn't sure what was going on because it's again, this is not a particular spoiler. This is known, but it'll feed into the second Doctor Strange film.
Okay, cool.
So once this episode will dovetail, and I think that's the ambition they have for all. They've got quite a few. They've got the Winter Soldier and the other one that flies around, whose name escapes me.
Something with the hawk involved?
Yeah, possibly.
I don't even
but
know.
But it's like quite a few of the characters and now have got their own TV series, which will all be featured on Disney Plus.
It does link in quite well with the topic that I was going to do after our one news item. So let's buck the trend and do a discussion-y thing before news. How revolutionary. But I was going to ask you, there's lots of series, be they film, book, comic, etc., they come with a lot of lore. They have a cinematic universe, to use the Marvel phrase, and there's all this world building behind them. And sometimes it can be incredibly extensive, where there might be a book, a story that happens in the universe, but the actual environment and time frame surrounding that one story is even more extensive than you could possibly imagine. Lord of the Rings is famously full of this kind of stuff, but there are lots of books on it. So my question is, excluding the story or any published works in that particular genre, which is your favourite chunk of lore, for want of a better phrase? Is it Middle-earth? Is it potentially the Warhammer 40K universe? That kind of stuff. Which do you enjoy most outside of the published works? In your mind, which would you think about most?
Which would you most want to experience?
Not necessarily,
experience, or?
But which are you most fascinated with?
Have to be the Star Trek universe,
to be honest.
Because of the... it's a very optimistic, although they have all their trials and tribulations. Generally, it's not dystopian, to them, more or less. So it's a very, although it's obviously projecting into the future, it's an optimistic future rather than some dreadful.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Sort of.
It doesn't get more dreadful, or as the phrase goes, grim dark, than the Warhammer 40,000 universe. That's as depressing and horrible as it gets.
I mean, it does seem that most of these type of works seem to lean towards the dystopian, which seems to be a trend.
Yeah, not exactly the right kind of tonic that we need at the moment, is it?
No, and exactly that. And maybe it's an age thing, but I prefer things that are uplifting and optimistic. I mean, I will watch all the I've thrashed through the Lord of the Rings film many times. Mm. I've not read the books. I'm not one for sort of reading novels as such. But I enjoyed the Lord of the Rings when it came out. I enjoyed The Hobbit, and I will be enjoying this new production that they're brewing up.
I'm worried about it, just because I don't want it to ruin my experience with the other films and things. But I'm interested, so I'll expect a detailed review on the first few episodes if you don't mind when it comes out.
I think they'll pull it off. I mean, I don't know when. I can't remember exactly when it's scheduled for, and I can't remember if it's a TV series, which it might be, because everything seems to be going to streaming services.
Yeah, I think it's going to be episodic. Do you know what time frame it covers?
It apparently covers 1,000 years before everything happened. It's a period which apparently ends when the gentleman whose name I can't remember,
the gentleman,
the protagonist in the Lord of the Rings.
Frodo.
No, that's the wrong... The actual...
The antagonist.
The antagonist, Sauron. Sorry, not the Sauron.
Ah, right. Yes.
So when Sauron has his finger, or his hand cut off, or his finger cut off, is where...
Gotcha, right.
So that, I believe that's supposed to be 1,000 years before the events of Lord of the Rings. And so I believe it's leading up to that point. So it's what happened prior to that.
Nice.
So it's kind of like the before times.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought, actually, about the whole dystopia versus the more hopeful world of Star Trek. My first, I have two, so I'll probably mention that. The first one is relatively narrow in its scope. If you're into your video games, a few that most likely won't have escaped your attention are the Half-Life and Portal series. Only a couple of games in the Portal series, much more in the Half-Life world. Both are set around scientific companies, Black Mesa in Half-Life. These are research sort of centres, and Aperture Sciences in Portal. In Portal 1, the facility you're kind of in is all, you know, gleaming and shiny and obviously in kind of full operating capacity. In the second, it is kind of destroyed. It's overgrown with sort of vines and things, and it's obviously not fully functional, and it's abandoned, all this kind of stuff. In Half-Life, it's a similar situation, but the deterioration happens much quicker. But what actually interested me is, I think I saw maybe a Reddit comment somewhere that said that canonically the event that happens in the beginning of Half-Life 1, the original game from 2 years before I was born, I think, I can't quite remember, that event is the same event that ruined Aperture Sciences in Portal, and there's quite a few different links. There's a few little Easter eggy bits where Cave Johnson, or recordings of Cave Johnson in Portal 2, mention those damn scientists from Black Mesa, or something, in my best dude from Whiplash impression. What's his name? J.K. Simmons. He voiced Cave Johnson. Really, really good performance, that. Anyway, sidetracking. It's a really small linking of two universes. There's a lot more kind of lore to the Half-Life world, but that conjunction of two video games that I really liked was quite pleasing when I discovered it. So that obsessed me for 30 minutes, but it was quite an enjoyable, obsessive researching half an hour.
And then those two games out the same software house.
Both developers. Valve, yeah.
Yeah, so
both Valve games.
So it's logical that they're doing a bit of world building there, and people totally like a bit of continuity and connections.
Yeah, there's a lot more of it in Half-Life, because that's more of an RPG, where Portal is essentially a puzzle game that just happens to have a really good kind of story around it. So limited scope for linking the two together. The second of the two that I mentioned and totally didn't forget and I'm an R about for a while, Hollow Knight. I've mentioned this game before because I love it so much. The soundtrack, the art is incredible. But second to none is the way the world is delivered to you and the way you can explore and learn for yourself. It's such an explorative kind of platformer, and there's so much detail in there. It would be very difficult to kind of piece this stuff together on your own, but you could spend the time. So with the aid of lots of YouTube videos and wiki, driven by the fascination that the environment creates as you're playing it, it's absolutely fantastic. For those of you who haven't played it, and I hope that portion of our audience diminishes significantly very quickly after listening to this podcast, because it's amazing, you've got to play Hollow Knight, it's great. You are a little thing, you've got a little white head with horns and a cloak, that you are a bug. This world is inhabited by bugs, creatures, little insectoid things. And you approach this sort of deserted town and you meet Elderbug, who tells you that it's kind of abandoned. There's a huge cavernous city and empire beneath this town that has gradually sort of, you know, lost the life and bustling activity that it used to have. But there's still some strange power that kind of draws adventurous insects and bugs from wilds beyond. That's a reference to the game. Anyway, to kind of explore. And all you really know is it sort of gets proposed to you vaguely early on that it was a once mighty kingdom, has now fallen, and through little lore tablets, interaction with the other inhabitants, and the general kind of story, really slowly piece together the kind of history of this world. And there's some really good kind of hour-long videos on YouTube that explain the whole thing if you just want to sit back and have it delivered to you after you've finished the game. I'd recommend that order. There was something about how vague everything is. It's quite dark and moody, but not necessarily depressing. It's just, I mean, it's kind of a cave. It is dark. But the pacing and how obscure it is, I was constantly just hungering for the information about it. You just want to learn about this world that you're playing through. It's really properly exquisite, and combined with, like I said, the soundtrack, the artwork, it's fantastic. Hollow Knight, just get in on it. There is a sequel coming up called Silk Song, where you play one of the characters who is in Hollow Knight, and I can't wait. There is no release date, so it's driving all the fans mad. We just want news of the new game, hopefully soon.
What platforms does that roll out on?
It's going to start on Switch and PC, which is kind of an odd combination. But then later it'll probably come to consoles, regular consoles, like Hollow Knight did. It's great on Switch, because you can just kind of it's that pickup ability of a handheld console. It's simple enough graphics that it plays really well, and just plug some headphones in and get stuck in. It's great on the PC too if you want to really get into the boss fights and do some of the boss rushes that are part of the sort of the end game. It is a little bit easier on PC just because of the layout of the controls, I've found. But I finished the game on Switch just fine. I say just fine. There was a lot of dying and redoing boss fights.
A lot of repetition.
If you're not into that and you don't build muscle memory especially well, or it might not be for you, because there's boss fights. A lot of them are very tricky. So it's not for everyone, the actual gameplay, but if you can kind of stomach that, the story is definitely worth it.
Okay, cool.
That would conclude our little lore, world-building, university-type something. And there is a small news item that we should get out of the way before we jump into some of our pre-prepared segments from our friends Luke and Telmo. It's the B-word again. Behringer are at it. This time, we have some insider knowledge to deploy that we've actually shared in a previous podcast quite a long time ago. I'm taking this from an article on Ask Audio, one of my favourite synthesizer-y music technology news websites. But Behringer have announced that they're doing a VCS3 clone. I mean, it was only a matter of time, really. It looks great. You know, it's that classic science lab-y upright panel, flat bit on the bottom thing that I've spoken about before. I just love that format. I don't know why. It's great. But an interesting thing that we want to draw your attention to is the circuitry is all analog and based on the original. Great. They're great at copying PCBs because they don't put any effort into anything. Even more interesting is that they've added many more functions in cooperation with an expert VCS modder from the UK. We know that expert VCS modder because he built his own Synthi A over quite a long time, an exhaustive effort. And it's a stunning machine. He's brought it to the ModCaf multiple times. Lovely guy. He told us a while ago that Uli Behringer himself got in contact and was like, exposing him to sort of lots of interest, saying, "Ooh, this is really cool. You've made this thing. What would happen if you did this type of thing?" You know, making feature suggestions, potentially. It transpires that he may have requested a bunch of amendments to our friend's designs. I don't know if he's actually PCB'd it at all, if it's all hand-wired, but his circuit diagrams anyway. And they may well have fallen into the hands of Uli Behringer. And now he's made this. And as far as I'm aware, no compensation is coming from Behringer to the guy who worked for many years on his replica of such a classic synthesizer. Take away from that what you will. It's only word of mouth from the guy that we know from the ModCaf, and I'm not going to tell you who it is. But there we go. More Behringer making no effort and not crediting where credit is due. That said, I will be quite excited to see it when it comes out.
Yeah, will it be even this? Will it be 2021 or 2022?
I'm trying to think. What's the one that we're currently waiting on the longest?
The 2600. Is it not?
When do they announce?
We talked about that at the beginning, or relatively when we started the podcast a year ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we thought, you know, it would take a long time. It would be mid-2020. I mean, admittedly, we didn't know there was going to be a pandemic.
That's true. That is true.
But even so, we're still waiting for it.
Yep. We're getting towards the end, but it is still not here.
I mean, I think we talked about it today, didn't we, when we were expecting. Did we actually say we had some dates, or did we not?
Oh, I think it might be mid-February.
Yes, so...
Yeah, a million miles away.
It would be interesting to see those when they come. So I'm not expecting to see it this year, potentially.
Oh, no, no way. Let's place my bet. End of 2022.
You think that long?
Partly because I don't see demand for this.
Yeah,
it's super cool, but I mean, who cares?
Yeah, I mean,
that much, because I mean, there's not many people in the past that have cloned this, partly because it is still in production by EMS, in production, kind of used loosely, because they're not easy to get your hands on. but also where's the demand? I know Erica Synths released the Syntrax, which is more synthy A shaped.
It's not cheap though.
No, it's not, and pretty limited in scope, in production scope. So
this will be cheap.
I mean, yeah, it's a B word, isn't it? If it turns out that it's completely analog, and as we've discussed before, there's no dodgy digital stuff happening, I could see myself potentially being quite interested if we get to play with one at the shop and it turns out it's actually quite good.
Yeah, as I say, if they stick to, as you say, no digitalization, if it's a way of describing it, it could be quite interesting. But yeah, I'm not, as I say, I fail to get excited about these.
Yeah, I mean, it's the silhouette that I'm excited by, and also just the pin matrix joystick format. It's just cool.
Yeah, you know? I remember seeing, in fact, I saw it actually, not live per se, but I did see it on the TV at the time, and it was, I think this happened on several occasions, it would have been Brian Eno playing one of these, and it was Roxy Music doing one of their chart-topping numbers, and that has been, I don't know, let's say 1974, 5?
It's an interesting world where there were synth adverts on TV. That's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall any, but I certainly remember, as I say, that particular thing, because it was unusual at the time. I was thinking, what is that? I was not au fait with the fact that it had been used relatively, I wouldn't say widespread, but you know, Pink Floyd used one, or the A.
I can't remember which.
Hawkwind had certainly got one. There was quite a few people.
Yeah. Do you remember what your first exposure to what a synthesizer is?
Well, I think the first point that I was conscious, and there was, I can't remember what they called, where they were called. Yeah, they were called Maplin, which obviously doesn't exist, which would in the US be the equivalent to Radio Shack. And they had a quite a lot. I assume it was monophonic, but they had a kit that I sort of lusted after. It was quite expensive, and I was looking at that, and I must have been 14, 15. And it looked kind of interesting. It just drew me in, all the sort of knobs and things like that. But it was, you know, I would have mostly not successfully constructed it, even if I could afford to buy it. So
I think I saw one of those pop up on one of the Facebook groups sort of a year or two ago, actually.
There was sort of in the consciousness, and I was aware of the sound of synthesizers. You know, I had some albums with, you know, the noises, but I didn't have a decent perception of how they were generated. You know, I knew they were electronic, but I didn't really understand them the way I understand them now in any shape or form. To be really, yeah. So the first one that I really became a bit more conscious when I bought a Yamaha, and this would have been 1979, possibly 1979, and I bought a Yamaha CS30.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah,
Was that the biggest of the
monophonic
the monos?
Yeah. With the step sequencer and all that sort of stuff, and didn't know how to use it.
Yeah, I was talking to our colleague Charles about the CS10 earlier today, I think.
Really?
Yeah, just because I was looking on Reverb just for a laugh, about £600. It's not too terrible for a vintage boy these days.
No. I mean, I almost feel that I'd like to get a good condition CS30 because, you know, just to sort of say that I've still got all, you know, it's not the original one I had, but I'd like to have all the synths I used to have. So that would be the CS30 and then a Jupiter 4.
Nice.
And a Juno 60.
That's a trio.
The things I've had and not have. The other two that I had really in the early days, I've still got.
Korg Lambda.
Korg Lambda.
What's
and
the other one?
The SH-101.
Oh,
from
82.
So, yes. And I did have a JX-3P after the Juno.
Oh, cool. Are there any synths that you had and got rid of and you're like, yeah, that was terrible, I would never have that again?
To be really honest, though they go for large money, the Jupiter 4 was...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it could be interesting now if you put it through some really nice effects, and I'm sure you could do anything, but I seem to remember at the time the sound palette on it was very limited. Mostly, maybe it's just me, but mostly it just sounded like an aggressive organ, even though it was a proper synth.
Yeah.
I mean, the one, obviously, at the time, the one I really lusted after and couldn't possibly afford was the Jupiter 8, which was a complete other thing. And then there was the Jupiter 6 that came out afterwards, which... commentators do say is potentially better sounding than the Jupiter 8, but the Jupiter 8 was the sort of the you know, the thing that you, you know, you aspire to. But it was, yeah, it was the same. I mean, it would have cost the same as buying, I don't know, at the time, I'm sure they were about £1,500. Mm. Might be more than that. In those times, £1,500 would have bought you quite a powerful and expensive motorcycle. And if you look at what motorcycles cost now, they're about £10,000 to £12,000. So,
yeah,
that's
different world.
Yeah, that's what it was looking at. And spookily, that's what a Jupiter 8 would go for now, about £10,000 to £12,000, isn't it?
Totally. Thankfully for me, the first synthesizer I owned was only a Korg Monologue, which is still in production and cheap. But the first synthesizer I remember being aware of and thinking, ooh, hello, like your Maplin Boyo, was actually Dope for Dark Energy, the first one.
Okay.
Like you, didn't really understand all the knobs and switches and patch points and stuff, but it just looked so intriguing. And that's how I got into synthesizers in general. I needed to understand it.
Yeah, they've always had an allure for me. There's something about them. It's the technical, you know, the sort of sci-fi side of it in some respects.
Yeah, and I do enjoy things that are perceived as quite difficult by a lot of people that haven't really spent any time researching and figuring out it's actually, you know, not that tricky. Like modular, looks very scary, but there's a logic to it. And if you learn the module, it's easy to use. And like solving a Rubik's Cube, that's super easy once you learn how. That kind of thing. A weird fascination with it, I suppose.
Yeah, there is that sort of side of things, because quite a few musicians don't really, you know, when you talk to guitarists or even other keyboard players that aren't really into synthesis as such, you know, they just, they're perplexed by them. You know,
yeah, because I came into music from more of the engineer's corner. Wanting to pursue music anyway, was sort of a recording engineering type perspective, which I suppose is why synthesizers and then modular attracted me. Anyway, for our listener, who I believe has binged a lot of our stuff, if not all of it, David, I hope you enjoyed that slightly more synthesizer-heavy section of this episode. But now it's actually time to hand over to Telmo, and Telmo is going to talk about jazz.
Hi, hello, and welcome to another segment of Let's Talk About Jazz with me, Telmo. Last week, we had a quick run through the importance and influence of a very particular progression in jazz music, the rhythm changes. This was a crucial and defining moment in the history of jazz that by exhaustive use was less prominent by the end of the 60s. With the development of free jazz, a strain with roots in some of the later work done by John Coltrane started to emerge. Ornette Coleman was a pioneer in this movement. Musicians were breaking down the form and rhythmic structure of jazz, and instead they were playing with the use of elements from non-Western music, especially African, Arabic, and Indian. The atonality of free jazz is often credited by historians and jazz performers to a return to a non-tonal music of the 19th century. It wouldn't be fair of me in talking about jazz fusion and not mentioning Miles Davis. Who else? I mean, the man played such a big part with the release of one of his most popular albums in the 1960s, Bitches Brew. Of course, Miles was incorporating some of the roots of the genre. He had Wayne Shorter on the soprano sax, but instead of having the piano, he had the electric piano, the Rhodes, recently released at the time, played by Joe Zawinul, but also Chick Corea, and of course, John McLaughlin on the guitar. At this time, the guitar had become a completely different monster, so Miles Davis thought that it would be nice to incorporate that in his ensemble. He also had several drum sets and percussion in different songs. These were used to create some sort of an orgy of sounds never really heard before. All of these developments laid the groundwork for the fusion and progressive jazz of the 1980s, where the use of synthesizers were abused by the likes of Herbie Hancock, creating massive hits like Rocket. This allowed groundbreaking work for legends like Jaco Pastorius to emerge in a popular culture, and provided a new voice for the electric bass guitar, in the same way that Jimi Hendrix did in the late 60s with the electric guitar. Of course, it's also important to mention the contrasting and rising popularity with smooth jazz, two completely different strains out of the same sort of genre. I believe that fusion was historically more important than smooth jazz. Due to its branching out to jazz metal, or to progressive rock, its core element resides on the experimentation that continued in the 1990s and the 2000s. Today, fusion can be viewed as a musical tradition or approach. It includes actually nowadays a lot of modern electronic sounds. I'm gonna leave you now with a truly fascinating modern piece of music. It's one of my favorite albums of all time. It's Flying Lotus's You're Dead. It's a great album. It really incorporates the best of what we can see and imagine of how exciting this fusion of sounds can become in the future. I really hope you've enjoyed this, and stay tuned for the next episode. I will be looking forward for it. Take it away, boys.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you, Telmo, for blowing my tiny, not especially musical mind with jazzy things. Another pre-recorded segment for us today. Always a pleasure to hear Luke's Spacey Bit. Take us beyond.
Hello, space fans, and welcome to our segment as I join our co-hosts from the distant past once again. 2021 is proving to be an exciting year in rocket design, with more news than usual from the Blue Origin direction and continued updates on the progress of SpaceX's Mammoth Starship project. Today, however, we're going to be taking on that titan of history, NASA, and see what they've been up to for the past little while. On the 16th of January, NASA tested the Space Launch System core block with all four of its engines for the first time. The test was supposed to last for 8 minutes to simulate the full burn that the engines would have to perform for their real mission. However, after 60 seconds, the system conducted an automated shutdown based on a main component failure. Nothing dramatic happened at the test site, and for all intents and purposes, the test was successful, proving that the engines can work with the SLS core assembly. Clearly, however, the SLS still has a few kinks that need to be ironed out. We've previously mentioned it on the show, but if you're not aware, NASA are planning to return to the moon, and this time, they're planning to stay. The Artemis program aims to launch an uncrewed mission entitled Artemis 1 to the moon in November of this year. The Orion capsule is the successor to the Apollo spacecraft and takes on a very similar appearance of a short cone, the flat side of which faces the Earth, taking on the brunt of the heat and friction upon re-entry. The capsule will enter the moon's sphere of influence, orbit for 6 days, and eventually return to Earth, bringing home with it a whole host of technical information on how to conduct future missions with human occupants. But how does Orion get to the moon? Well, since 2011, NASA have been building and testing the Space Launch System, its enormous, super heavy lift expendable launch vehicle. The aim for the SLS project is to become the primary launch vehicle for all of NASA, and what they term their deep space exploration plans. This includes the Artemis program to deliver people and hardware to the moon, the establishment of a lunar orbital gateway station, and possible crewed missions to Mars. Now, being a sci-fi nut, I wouldn't call any of those destinations quote-unquote deep in any sense, considering the absolute scale of the universe, but these are certainly the farthest frontiers of human space travel, so nonetheless, I'm glad they're being pursued. More on this sentiment later. So what is the SLS? Well, Artemis 1 specifically will be a 27-ton, 98.5-meter machine made up of a liquid and oxidizer-fueled central core block using four massive RS-25 engines and two solid rocket fuel boosters to propel the Orion capsule and ESA service module towards the moon. If any of that sounded familiar, that's because it is. The RS-25s are hugely powerful space shuttle engines now repurposed and refurbished with the modern processors and avionics that you would expect of today's engines. You may remember it from the space shuttle launches. The RS-25s produced that beautiful, terrifying engine flare like God's blowtorch. The iconic blue cone suspended away from the engine bell in a torrent of translucent fire. It's seriously cool to watch, and it's one of my favourite engines in the sort of space engineering sphere. But here is why I have to explain why the SLS makes me a little bit sad. As I said, the craft is expendable. No part of the launch vehicle is intended to be reusable. The guiding design philosophy of the SLS is to get to the moon permanently and quickly. To that end, the SLS will be reusing old parts from the space shuttle program, which I'm always happy to hear about recycling in the space engineering industry, but the SLS falls a step short. It mimics the design of the Saturn V and space shuttle, wasting resources instead of preserving them. Given the amount of energy and expenditure involved in space exploration, surely every effort should be made to reuse as much of the craft as possible. There are several issues in the way here. Firstly, the SLS core block is too big to be rescued. But what about SpaceX, I hear you say? Well, yes, the Starship is its own thing. It's a steel behemoth, a real-life Thunderbird. The Falcon 9 is a much better comparison to the SLS. But the Falcon 9's reusable first stage doesn't get up to the same altitude as the SLS core, which therefore will be travelling much faster. Slowing the SLS core down during re-entry would require additional propellant for a braking burn, as well as parachutes and advanced avionics that the system currently isn't equipped with. Starship proves that this can be done with a big vehicle, but the flimsy plastic and foam body of the SLS core is not destined or designed to be saved. Which is a real shame, as NASA will chew through their supply of historic RS-25 engines until their planned replacement in the late 2020s. To my sentimental mind, the space shuttle engines deserve to be used in a more advanced craft with sustainability built in. That said, I'm not a rocket engineer. The SLS might not be quite what we wanted, but it certainly is what we have. It is a system that will be used to put the first woman on the moon, so I can only hope that the project is successful. It certainly is an incredible machine, which finally sees NASA emerging from the shadow of the Saturn V. Cynicism aside, the SLS will probably be responsible for changing our future and bringing about human habitation on and around the moon. That's if the contracts aren't given to private companies in the near future. But anyway, that's the end of our segment. I hope you've enjoyed the story. Please do contact us via social media if you have anything to discuss. Even if you just want to chat, we'd love to hear from you regarding space, synths, music, games, corona, all sorts. Next week we'll be back with more space news, but for now I'll return you to my co-hosts. Stay safe, bye-bye.
And thank you, Luke, once again. Are we still Stairwell Studios? I don't know where we are, but thank you.
I thought we were Wardrobe.
Wardrobe Studios? Stairwell Studios?
Actually, to be honest, he's got his whole recording set up quite well now.
The jet engine of a computer has been silenced to some degree.
Because from the recent remote record we did last week, his stem was actually quite clean.
Better than mine with my terrible room sound.
Yeah, he certainly hasn't got any reverby room to deal with.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right. I've got tools for that.
Yeah, the SM7B, as I was saying earlier, definitely in the slightly more immediate future than I had expected. The requirement for one has kind of sprung upon us rather than the, ooh, actually, that's a great mic, I would like it. It would actually be a proper tool to have, which I would quite
certainly
like.
Certainly will.
I'll hand it over to you for the first YouTube recommendation of our multimedia recommendation. Multimedia recommendation, however you want to do it. While I hunt for one of my own, because off you go.
Well, this is one I've come across recently, and I'm hoping it's not one that you guys or our other contributors to the podcast have suggested. But it's new to me, so hopefully they haven't gone. It's called Half as Interesting.
Okay.
Not heard of it?
Don't think so.
Okay, good. Right. So it's one of these ones where they take a factoid and they sort of pull it out into an interesting 5 to 10 minute expose on that particular theme that they've chosen. So let's just select. Here's one: how the QWERTY keyboard broke the Chinese language.
Oh, cool.
So they're well done. There's a selection of it's no one talking to camera. It's sort of informatics and pictures and so forth like that. But yeah, they're as I say, not too taxing, and you can peruse them or just listen to them in series and decide as another one. I mean, some of the sort of facts I've heard: how a cartel built their own phone network.
Nice.
Which I believe was
Knowledge.
I don't know if it was one of the Colombian ones, but yeah, sort of nuggets of bits and pieces. How astronauts vote from space.
Oh, cool. Never even considered such a thing.
Yeah, well, what do you do when you're doing a six-month tour of duty on the ISS? But yeah, so yeah, half as interesting.
Nice one. I do actually have a musical one and a synthy one. So again, David, you're welcome. This one is a channel called Ambalek. I will spell that out for you in a bit. Mostly ambient, mostly modular, and just really great. There's some Seat Lombard instruments in there, which I still have a fascination with. The what's that company with the things? Yeah, very specific. Otto Machines, the Bim Bam and Boom. Those are in there. Lots of modular in a big old Pittsburgh structure case. We got some Electron action in there, so you know, some pretty serious hefty gear in there. It's just all great. Really nice, relaxing, ambient stuff. Some of them do get a bit more experimental and noisy if you like that kind of thing, but lots of variety. So Ambalek, which is AMBALEK _ Ambalek on YouTube. Really nice stuff. That brings us to the end. As always, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We really do appreciate your listens. And please, because I didn't ask you at the beginning of the podcast, which is probably the best time to do it, do engage with us on social media. Facebook and YouTube are probably the best ones. At RackAddictsUK. Come say hi and have a great evening, potentially, or whatever time of day it might be. Have a good few hours of... Bye.